Well, welcome back, class. This is our week on origins, and we're going to talk today about the intelligent design movement. It's a movement that's largely discredited by the official scientific community. Its motives are seen as being a little questionable. A lot of times they try to differentiate themselves from creationism, which is a position that takes just the Bible as its starting point, and then seeks to explain what's seen in science on the basis of the Bible. Intelligent design positions itself as purely scientific, philosophically scientific, where the processes of everyday life are used then to explain the things that are seen. And so it wants to establish itself on the basis of kind of an empirical, rational system, a rational basis. The article that you're going to read over the weekend is by Stephen Meyer, one of the leading advocates of this position. He's been a leading advocate for years. He did a dissertation at Cambridge about the kind of logic that is used in the intelligent design movement. I'm going to talk about that logic today. He's going to explain not only the ideas of the movement, but also the history of the movement. One of the key individuals in the history of that movement is Philip Johnson. You read one of his articles today, the response to Stephen Jay Gould's review of Johnson's book. These two men have an interesting little history to them. Johnson was a Berkeley lawyer. He died a couple years ago, so that's why I use was. He was a law professor at Berkeley and was on sabbatical in London and didn't know what he was going to do for research for that time period. But as he was walking down the street in a bookstore window, he saw Richard Dawkins' book, The Blind Watchmaker. Next to it, Michael Denton's book, Evolution, A Theory in Crisis. And when he looked at him, he said, well, there's a debate. And so he started studying that in order to know the shape of their arguments. I mean, obviously, he's a lawyer, and so a debate to establish truth on the grounds of evidence is something that he would be familiar with. And so as he did his analysis of the debate and the tactics used, he eventually came to see that evolution was not on a very strong footing and that its case was actually not very strong. So he started developing this theory that, you know, Darwin on Trial is his book, and it's basically then, if Darwin were put on trial, how strong would the case be? Well, he test drove his book first among the Berkeley faculty, brought in some philosophers and scientists, and they found some validity to his work. Maybe they didn't agree, but it had substance. And so being encouraged, he actually took his work to Boston and had conversation with Stephen Jay Gould and others. So when you read this interchange in which Johnson had used a lot of Gould's work, the Harvard paleontologist, and then Gould responds it's a kind of an ad hominem approach. There seems to be some anger involved. There's a back history. The first time those men met, from what I read in a book, Thomas Woodward described their meeting in the history of the movement, that there was also a very angry interchange there too. And I think you see it in what Gould says. Basically, Johnson is stepping out of his expertise. There's kind of an offense given. I mean, here's a Harvard paleontologist who's given his life to this study. Who's this lawyer? And you know how lawyers are, the way they think. They don't think like the rest of us. Now, before you jump to the defense of the lawyer, the law community, it's true. Law uses language in a very precise way. It has to. Terms don't wiggle. They don't shift and change around. And so your use of language and the logic that you use on the basis of language shares so much similarities to philosophy. So we would not expect a lawyer to say, you know, be writing kind of books with lots of nuanced language and images that have double entendres and more than one meanings or mystery. A law mind is a very precise mind. But so is science. You know, so in one sense, it's like, okay, but so are scientists. They like to be precise, define things, and it's not, we're not dealing with art and literature and poetry. So on the one hand, I understand what he's saying. On the other hand, a lawyer looking at a debate, I can see it's creative. You know, it's applying it in a new area, but he would be skilled in understanding how a case can be made or not made. At any rate, Gould has even a deeper objection, and that he has a fact-value split. I hope you could see that. He's very much the idea that morality is over there in the personal, your values, and science is over here with the facts. And they're not together. They should be kept separate. So when Gould says, look, you can be religious. There's many scientists have been religious. He has this kind of religion in mind. In other words, a religion that knows its place. It's for your personal lifestyle. And of course, an evolutionary scientist could have, you know, basically an atheistic science in the sense there's no God needed to make this process happen, and yet personally could be very religious, as has been in like a case that he mentions. And so that kind of fact-value split is common, and we're going to talk about that as a methodological naturalism in a bit. It's interesting, I think Johnson includes in his response that racism would be a great modern example of you can't live with that kind of a split. Nobody's going to accept my personal values if I regard this or that race or skin color to be inferior or superior. And that's my personal values. That's not acceptable. And the reason it's not acceptable is that it doesn't comport to what we see physically among the peoples. Human is human. DNA is DNA. People are people. And so, whew, okay, you ever got the idea there. Then Michael Ruse comes along in that, having had interaction with Johnson at a conference in which he realized that there are philosophical assumptions that I bring to my thinking about science and its implications. In other words, I have metaphysical assumptions that in one sense are religious in nature. And I would say that's just being human. Even an atheist has a view of God in that he has a view of the being that he rejects exists. And everybody has religious assumptions as they do their work, regardless of, say, what it is. And it impinges upon it more or less. So, okay. This is what your reading is for today. We're going to be looking at the intelligent design movement. And to do so, I'm going to use a handout that's the Indo-European languages. And we're going to talk about that at the end. So I want to make sure that you have that handout with you and ready to go. So when I point out some things at the end, I can make use of that readily. Well, let's give a definition first of intelligent design. And then talk about some of its background. And so the intelligent design movement, the definition is there's a design inference. It's the best explanation of what we see in nature. We see the appearance of design in nature, and we infer from that a designer. Okay, does that make sense? Okay, good. So, everybody agrees on the appearance of design. All sides are in agreement that when you look at the world, it appears to be designed. One of the quotes that Johnson brings, in fact, he puts it at the top of his article, is a quote from Richard Dawkins. Biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. Now, Dawkins is an atheist who said evolution has made me an intellectually satisfied atheist, Oxford zoologist, popularizer. Yet he himself says, biology is the study of complicated things, the word complex is going to be important for us, that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. Johnson and others have quotes to the same effect from other Darwinian scientists. One that I read in a different book that I used to use for this course was from George Gaylord Simpson. You can tell it's from the middle of the 20th century by what it mentioned. The telescope, a telephone, or a typewriter. Some of you maybe have never seen a typewriter. Is a complex mechanism serving a particular function. Obviously, its manufacturer had a purpose in mind, and the machine was designed and built in order to serve that purpose. An eye, an ear, or a hand is also a complex mechanism serving a particular function. It, too, looks as if it had been made for a purpose. This appearance of purposefulness is pervading in nature. So, no matter where you go, pervasively, nature gives the appearance of having been designed for a particular function or purpose. Johnson has a quote from A.G. Karen Smith from the book Seven Clues to the Origin of Life, in which the author says, another Darwinian evolutionist, after all, what impresses us about a living thing is its inbuilt ingenuity, its appearance of having been designed, thought out, of having been put together with a purpose. Commenting on that, Johnson says, Karen Smith also describes the, quote, messages contained in the genetic information stored in the, quote, library of each cell's DNA, which are transcribed and translated to direct the synthesis of proteins. His language is entirely typical of others who write about this subject. Practically all stress the appearance of design and purpose, the immense complexity of the simplest cell, and the apparent need for many complex components to work together to sustain life. Everyone uses the vocabulary of intelligent communication to describe protein synthesis. Messages, programmed instructions, languages, information, coding and decoding, libraries. Of course, you understand, this is my comment here. All those are metaphors, but they draw upon those metaphors from human life in order to explain it, what is happening within the cell. So Johnson concludes, why not consider the possibility that life is what it so evidently seems to be, the product of creative intelligence. So, while all agree in the appearance of design, the question becomes, is that appearance real? Now, I'm going to argue from the book from the Bible, there must be some measure, some way that God manifests himself through the created order to mankind. Otherwise, according to the book of Romans, guilt cannot be established. People could plead innocence. If you go to Romans chapter 1, God says, since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes and eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that men are without excuse. There's an irony in there. His invisible attributes have been clearly seen. And then Paul describes, how could something invisible be seen? They're understood, right? They're seen with the mind's eye, being understood through what has been made. Now that could be providence, as God interacts with us in his world, or it could be by inference, based on there's things that exist, and I have to have a first cause or prime mover, or it could be both. But in any regard, it is inescapable that there is revealed data about God given to me, mediated through what has been made, so that I am without excuse. When I've thought about that, I've realized I myself am part of that creation. I cannot escape the witness God has left in this world to his goodness and to his presence. I myself am part of that world, and I live in among his furniture. So all around me is witness to who he is, what he's about. There is a God. Now, that's the basis, according to Romans, the Apostle Paul, Apostle of Jesus Christ, that is the basis for the whole case of Christianity. If that's removed and there's some kind of Kantian separation where the box that we live in is so sealed from the metaphysical that I cannot infer anything from the phenomenal, from inside the box to outside the box, if it's that tight, well then yeah, I can plead ignorance. I didn't know. You didn't talk to me. I had no knowledge. But according to the Bible, that's impossible. God bears witness. He has not left himself, Paul said to some pagans. He's not left himself without witness. And so in another place, Paul found an altar to an unknown God. And the reason why God does this or that historically and in his world is in order that people would seek him, if perchance they might find him, if they might grope after him. And so the obligation of man, he's held for only the knowledge that he has, and the obligation, the duty that's pressed upon him is to seek out more information and ultimately to seek out this being who's behind all that he sees and experiences. Now, so I'm just going to say that up front. There has to be some way that God manifests himself and some way that the Kantian divide is bridged. Otherwise, guilt would not be established and mankind would be excusable on the basis of ignorance. Well, let's return then to the question, is the appearance of design real? Because this then would give, this appearance of design in my mind is one of the witnesses God has left in the world. And so, is it real? Or is it just a charade? Well, if you're a philosophical naturalist, in other words, a materialist, all you believe is matter and energy. That's all that exists. Even human beings, though they appear to make choices, are just very complicated organisms responding to stimuli. And so it's an illusion of freedom when you look at the human. That kind of philosophical materialism. If that's your position, of course, this you already have your answer. You don't even need to investigate. It is merely an appearance. It's a marvelous mirage, but it's just an appearance. Now, if you're a methodological naturalist, in other words, like at the end of Michael Ruse's transcript, Eugenia Scott, I believe it is, brings up the fact, well, yes, maybe we have metaphysical views and whatever, but in the laboratory, those don't come into play when we're evaluating data. The laboratory is looking for natural causes, investigating it using various mechanisms and equipment, and so it gives us data. Whether we believe in a God or don't believe in a God isn't going to change the fact, you know, of the density of water or of the boiling point of, you know, this or that substance. So we can safely leave our religion at the door we enter into the laboratory would be the kind of position of a methodological naturalist. And, you know, it would seem like there's some validity to this. I don't want to close my eyes to what is out there in the world just because I hold to this or that religiously. That's a fact-value split, isn't it? But on the other hand, you know, I don't want to close my eyes to whatever might be implied religiously about what I've experienced or am seeing while I'm examining this or that fact. Why not have my eyes open to everything? And so a methodological naturalist would basically respond, is the appearance of design real? It's irrelevant to what we're doing. I mean, it just doesn't matter if it's real or not real. Well, the challenge to that is theories are made to account for more and more phenomena. They don't just remain small. They become bigger and bigger and bigger. And the more they're only looking for natural causation, methodologically designed that way, the more possibility exists that something is not being accounted for. Let me give you an example of this. if I came into the classroom before class, and I'm the only one there typically, and I'm putting things on the board, and I discovered a dead body, I mean, God forbid, but a dead body, and I call up security, and the police show up, and an investigation ensues. If the crime scene investigation comes into it only looking for natural causes, stroke, heart attack, do the autopsy, and doesn't take into account the possibility of foul play, of an intelligent being behind what is seen here, you and I would question the wisdom of that approach. Because you and I know that it is at least possible that this was foul play and that somebody had premeditated a murder. Well, forensic science is open to the possibility of intelligences being behind phenomena that are seen. It's that kind of a thing, a predisposition to be open to. Perhaps some of the causation here is due to intelligence. That kind of open-mindedness is what I'm arguing for. When it comes to literature, the same kind of thing happens. I come into a piece of literature or a piece of, say, a movie or something, you know, a message, a story that's given to me. I come into it with certain expectations. Maybe it's an expectation that it be serious or that it be funny. It'll color the way that I respond to the work. For example, there was several years ago, I was a new pastor in the area. One of our students was at a Christian college, and I was concerned about her welfare, and so I wanted to go visit the college and just see, you know, what is she learning, what is she receiving. And I come to find out, I grabbed the campus newspaper, and wow, there's like, in chapel, there's a light show, they got the smoke machine going, and as a new pastor in the area, I'm going, what is going on at the chapel? Come to find out later, the story was a spoof. The campus newspaper is a mixture of things both, you know, of both credible news and entertainment. And so it was a story that was meant to entertain the students. And if I had been on campus and knew the nature of that college newspaper, I would have come at it with some level of expectation and wouldn't have been fooled. But as it was, I assumed serious journalism and was greatly offended, and I misinterpreted the data as a result. This is so common. Every relationship is like that. We come into a relationship with some measure of trust, and if that trust is broken, everything that person says is colored with distrust, and I'm suspicious. It takes much to bring back a level of trust, to take them seriously at their word. All that is saying is you will see basically what you expect to see. And if you're trained to look for certain kinds of data, that's the kind of data that you will find, and you will inadvertently, not uncommonly, overlook something that was there all along, you just weren't trained to see it. Philip Johnson's contention, in part, was that when people would go out, you know, studying about evolution, they would look for evolutionary data. They would look for things that supported evolution. And if they didn't find it, they would conclude there was no results, nothing seen. When in actuality, Johnson was saying, well, maybe some of the things that were seen would have indicated something else if their mind had been more open or their eyes had been trained to look in more directions than just one. This is a large issue, and it pertains then to both the scientific enterprise as well as personal relationships. To be open to wherever the evidence leads you. And so the case, basically the position of the intelligent design movement is that there are some things in nature that do infer a designer, and that it would be scientifically legitimate to draw that inference and to conclude there is an evidence of a mind behind this phenomenon. Well, to do that, to make the inference, you have to use a certain kind of logic. So I wanted to explain the three kinds of logic, and then the one that gets used in this movement, the one that Stephen Meyer in his article that you'll read over the weekend describes. The first kind of logic is deduction. Deduction is kind of a top-down logic. I mean, it starts with a definition, or it starts with certain axioms or postulates, statements you assume, and then it draws inference on the basis of the law of non-contradiction. And so it will then, you know, start out by saying, because this is true, therefore this is true, therefore this is true. The syllogism is a classical example of this. Two premises and a conclusion. Of course, the conclusion becomes a premise for something else, which then becomes a premise for something else. And then you build a big, consistent system as a result. Geometry is a classic example of this. Certain postulates, you assume that parallel lines do not meet. Two parallel lines in a plane do not meet. Well, you can assume something different. You can assume that two parallel lines do meet. Now, if they converge or diverge, I think you end up with, you know, Riemannian geometry or Lobachevskian geometry, where if you assume that they never meet, you have Euclidean geometry. All three geometries are valid, which means they're internally consistent based on the assumptions that you made. None of them may be actually true. Truth is not the same thing as validity. The truth of a whole system is all predicated on whether the assumptions you bring into it are true. If the assumptions are true, then it logically follows everything else must be true. And so, if we find out with regard to geometry, I'm told that basically deep space and the space-time continuum and how space bends around large centers of gravity, that a non-Euclidean geometry works very well modeling that kind of a scenario, where for us in our classroom here on Earth, you know, Euclidean geometry works really well. We are definitely not in the midst of a large center of gravity. And so that's a blessing. So, I hope you understand then that deductive logic is internally consistent, but is only as good as the assumptions that are made initially. Now, induction works the other way. Induction kind of works ground up, like a grassroots kind of a thing. Induction goes out and looks at all the data, and then collects all the data it can find, and draws a generalized conclusion. So it moves from data to a generalization, which this is much of what traditional science is about. You know, that there's been a lot of inductive, you know, data collecting, empiricism, and drawing a conclusion. And those that deal with statistics, you have to have, you know, a statistical, you know, kind of reliability, a threshold of so many samples randomly collected and then, you know, handled in a particular way to bring out this is the conclusion. Now, just like a deductive system is not necessarily true, it all depends on what you assume going into it, an inductive system can never be airtight. Because all it takes is one counterexample, and the whole thing is canceled. So I can go and say I can visit funeral after funeral after funeral after funeral and have maybe, you know, like trail cams set up at cemetery after cemetery after cemetery after cemetery and take data after data and go millions of people have died and not one of them has risen from the dead. Therefore, human beings do not rise from the dead. Well, as a Christian, I would acknowledge that's a normal fact of present day experience. But Christianity then would turn around and say, but there is one exception to that, or there is one counterexample that shows that the dead do rise, and that would then nullify the theory that human beings do not rise from the dead. So I hope you can see that it leads to some level of frustration. You know, you'd want to have some kind of the Enlightenment, remember, wanted to get the big picture. And so on the basis of rationalism, which is a deductive more approach, or empiricism, which is more inductive, on the basis of just pure reason, that we could gain certain knowledge. But this shows that that's not attainable. It's only as good as the assumptions you bring, and then even if you draw generalizations from a ton of research, one counterexample can wipe it all away. And so absolute certainty is forbidden humankind, just like it was Job and his friends, and a level of fallibility is given to us. Well, the third kind of logic I was not familiar with, and Stephen Meyer popularizes it in the intelligent design movement, but it actually goes back, I believe, to the 1800s and Charles Peirce. It's called abduction. And so basically it's a historical approach, or it's logic used in the history disciplines, where you come up with the best explanation for an event. And so normally it would be a logical fallacy, the way it argues. You know, if it snows on Saturday, then we will cancel the picnic. And so I find out, hey, the picnic was canceled. Ah, it must have snowed. Well, that's assuming the consequent. That's a logical fallacy. You know, the converse is not always true. Yes, maybe it's true that if it snows, then we will cancel the picnic. But there's other reasons. You know, maybe we cancel the picnic because everybody got, you know, a virus. We're talking a lot this year about a virus, you know. So maybe everybody got sick and so we canceled it. Or there could be a lot of reasons. Where abduction works well is when there's only one known cause for a particular effect. So here's my example for that. I'm standing out in the middle of a field on a cloudless day at noon. Bright blue sky. And then the sky slowly darkens to the point where the night sounds among the crickets come, and then it slowly lightens back up again. There's only one known cause for a darkening like that in the middle of a day, of a bright blue sky, cloudless day. And that's a solar eclipse. And so it would be valid for me to assume, to infer from that data, that an eclipse occurred. A solar eclipse just occurred. Well, it's that kind of a reasoning that is used among the intelligence design. It's the design inference. There are certain kinds of complexities that have only one known cause, intelligence. So if you're looking for causal adequacy, an explanation that can account for this effect, the effect is a great effect, and you're looking for not a lesser but a greater. If you're looking for an explanation, a best explanation for this effect, we have only one known cause for that kind of complexity, and it's intelligence. Therefore, based on everyday experience, one known cause, the present being key to the past, based on universal present experience, it would be reasonable to infer that there is an intelligence behind this phenomenon. Well, let's talk then about the complexities that are seen. There's three areas that are brought up in the article, and they still are the three areas of kind of like discussion today. Two of them have the complexities that we're talking about. So let's go to the first. Actually, I think all three do, but the two are emphasized in your article. So the first area is molecular biology, DNA, which to me is fascinating. It's like there's digital information behind all living organisms. I learned in physics that, you know, in quantum mechanics, it'd be physics and chemistry, that energy is only at particular levels. It's quanta. They're in, you know, each quantum. It's, in other words, quantified. You can actually kind of like count them. There's no kind of sliding scale. It's either this or it's this or it's this at very precise points. And so it's fascinating to me that whether you look at, you know, physics and chemistry, or whether you look at living organisms and biology, that the world is digital. It's not analog. It's not on a sliding scale. And so as you look at that, how do you explain it? Where did that information come from on the spine of the double helix of a DNA? Well, they use a filter. The intelligence design movement uses a filter, and I think it maybe came from William Dembski, to explain this. In nature, there are some things that are just random. You know, raindrops hitting your windshield as you're driving down the road, are random. Random means it's like the static, you know, for on a radio where it's not tuned into anything. It's erratic. There's no pattern to it at all. It's very irregular and complex. So there's no mathematical model that could be given to it. Things that are natural, things that have a natural cause, are regular and not complex. Now, they can be hard to understand, but by not complex, we mean they are mathematically modeled. You can put a mathematical model on it. It might be as complicated, say, as a wave function or something, but you can still map it out with math. If you can do that, then there's a natural cause behind it. The sign of intelligence is when something is regular, but so complex you can't have a mathematical formula that would predict then what would happen next. This lecture is of that nature. It is regular in that it has to follow the rules of English in order for you to understand it, but it's complex because there's no student out there who's going to come to me and say, Dr. Snyder, I have exactly a formula that's going to exactly predict what you're going to say today. Now, maybe sometimes I am that predictable. I go to a certain restaurant and I always order a certain thing or something. But when I'm talking, it's too complex. And yet it has to be specified by the rules of English grammar. That kind of complexity is called a specified complexity. It is the hallmark of information. And the claim is made by the intelligence design movement that it is that kind of complexity that we see with DNA. There's no chemical determinancy on where the amino acids, the proteins, or whatever are going to line up on the DNA. There's no chemical determinancy. It has to be, by its nature, non-determinant. And yet, it follows in a particular pattern that then tells that these particular proteins should be synthesized and life should be organized in a particular way. And so, their argument is that what we find in the nature of DNA is information, and there's only one known cause for information, and that's intelligence. A good example of what we're talking about here is the search for extraterrestrial intelligence called SETI. S-E-T-I. They put this big radar dish to outer space and they're collecting all this electromagnetic radiation. And is there any kind of variation in the blips? At one time they thought they discovered intelligence. I'm sure it happened more than once, but this one I read about in a book. And so can you imagine the excitement after all the static, after all the randomness? Hey, listen to that. Well, the bummer was they found out that it was not actually intelligence. It was too regular. I think it was a pulsar. And so a pulsating star, I think, which is a double star out there, was giving that kind of data off. And so it was not intelligence. It was natural and could be mathematically modeled. So whether it's forensic science, whether it's the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, I think the gaming industry creates models that also have to account for intelligence. There are algorithms and protocols in place that can filter out whether intelligence is there or not there, and it's all on the basis of this kind of looking for specified complexity. And the claim is made that if we were open to that kind of openness that these other scientific endeavors involve, we also would conclude or infer, and it'll be reasonable, that there is intelligence behind DNA. Now, the cellular biology is another area. The nanotechnology, I like that word, the nanotechnology inside the cell. Michael Behe was, a cellular biologist in Lehigh University and came out with the book, Darwin's Black Box, that talks about this. It's a book I haven't read, but it testifies to this fact. It's going to be summarized in the Myers article. And basically, as he saw, what Darwin considered to be something simple, a cell, when we opened the box, it was amazing. It's like a factory. There's so much complex machines, living machines, as it were, doing jobs inside the cell. And so, how do you account for this nanotechnology? He gives the example of a bacteria. So here, I'd have to draw you a picture, but think of a little blob with a little squiggle tail on it. When I used to see pictures of that squiggle tail, the flagellum, the whip-like tail on a one-celled, creature, I used to think it kind of went back and forth and whipped. But it actually is like a propeller. It spins. And of course, in order to spin, it's got to actually be free from, it can't be connected to, the object that it's propelling. In order to spin 380, 360 degrees, all the way around, like again, 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 again. Amazingly, I am told that little bugger can spin up to 100,000 RPM. That's revolutions per minute. It's amazingly fast. And so it takes 30 proteins to create that rotor assembly on that creature. The argument is that there is no possible way that you can account for 30 proteins all doing their job. You can't account for that in an incremental fashion, evolutionary incremental fashion of this first developed and that first developed and this developed. It's an irreducible complexity because the complexity of that mechanism, it will not work half-formed. All the mechanisms, all the proteins have to be in place for it to function at all. And so you couldn't go from 27, 28, 29 and have some function, a little more function, a little more function. When I read The Origin of Species, this argument actually shows up more than once. And it reminds me, and again I say, that Darwin, this is Darwin's genius. Whether you agree with him or not, and in his one long argument, has places definitely that should be questioned on its logic. One thing you can say, he anticipated much of the debate. He already laid out the grounds. He had thought through about the theory. This is how it could be falsified. He tells it. He's confident that it's not going to be falsified, but he tells you this is how it would be falsified. One of the ways in which it could be falsified is on irreducible complexity. He says flat out, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ, notice the word complex, notice the word any, he just takes one counterexample, right? If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed, which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. Okay, do you see the point? In other words, if you could show irreducible complexity to be an absolute certainty, my theory completely breaks down. Darwinian evolution is not a fact. It's Michael Behe that still, I'm told, holds to evolution. At least one article I read, he says that, but not Darwinian evolution, almost obviously, because it does not come about in this incremental fashion according to his mind. In fact, he says it can't. So there's the challenge. Now I know, within every debate, there's always people who will answer it, right? And so they're on how do I explain it? Well, maybe this component of 15 and this component of 15, they both had functions, and then they combine together, and you get the flagellum. Well, maybe that's so, you know, but how likely is it? Again, with these kind of things, when you're generalizing and arguing, certainty is not something that you can necessarily come to. But a reasonable conclusion, I think, is something that you would want to come to. You don't want to believe things irrationally. We're looking for a fact-value union if we can have it. Ultimately, I think it's only going to be on the basis of Scripture that you can have certainty. It's going to be a matter of faith. But it will be a faith that does not deny what is factual, because it will be a combining of the two. Though not completely explaining the factual, there will always be mystery, as Job and his friends experienced. Some of it described, by the way, the chemical indeterminacy of the DNA, of what's on the DNA, as also an irreducible complexity. You cannot reduce it to mathematical laws. I guess I'll leave you to explore that possibility. Number three, the fine-tuned universe. The first explanation I heard of this was by J.P. Moreland, a Christian philosopher. He came to campus, and he explained it in this way. For life to exist, the constants of the universe have to be set at a certain point. By the constants of the universe, we mean things like the speed of light. What is it, 185,000 miles a second, something like that. Or the, you know, max Planck's constant, the ratio of, what is it, frequency to energy, something like that. There's a ton of constants in the physical universe. And in order for life to exist, they all have to be set at a certain point. This is what it would make. This would be similar then to irreducible complexity. There's no incremental getting to that point. They all need to be set for life to exist at a certain point. And so it would be like coming into a large control room with 100 knobs on the wall. And as you examine this control room, and nobody's in there, each knob is set at the precise place it needs to be set for life to exist. It would be reasonable to conclude somebody has come in here and said it. Like, intelligence would be the reasonable conclusion. It would be, the burden of proof would be on the other side to prove that it's not. To assume that it's not would be an unreasonable inference. Does that make sense? That's the kind of nature that we're dealing with here. And I like to bring this up, as I said earlier, because it lets students come into the book of Genesis with a more open mind that maybe the doctrine of creation, of an infinite personal God creating the world from nothing, maybe that teaching has some scientific validity, that it can be compatible to what we see and experience in this world every day. If that's happening in your mind, then this lecture and the others previously are achieving its purpose. Well, let me close with a model that it's an analogy that has helped me, and that I think has, you know, some explanatory power. It's interesting. Students have often asked me, you know, so what's your position? I think by now, if you've listened carefully, you'd understand that I'm not theistic evolution, and nor am I intelligent design. Though I think their logic is actually has some validity to it. I'm fascinated by the way they argue. And I do believe, as Paul said to the pagans, that God has not left himself without witness. And so the appearance of design qualifies in my mind as one of the witnesses God has left in this world. And I think it'll hold people accountable. But as Romans 1 says, we have a tendency as people to suppress the truth in unrighteousness, wanting to hold to a view of the universe with myself as its center and my pride and whatever. We are not inclined to go out and look for God in all that we see. And so the fact that there are theories that don't take God into account is readily explainable in the Bible based on the nature of humans as it presents it. Well, here's the model. If you look at the sheet of Indo-European languages, you will see that most of them are you know, in Europe, Germanic, Celtic, Greek, and such. But some of them are in Asia, Indian and Iranian, and some are along the way, Armenian and Albanian. What they discovered, I think this was in the 1700s, is that the structure of the languages in India, Hindi, Bengali, and such, and then in Persia, Farsi and things, the structure of those languages are the same as the structure of the languages in Europe, which speaks to a common origin, that at one time, the European peoples were in Asia, that they both came from the same part of the world, Central Asia. It's that kind of an argument that is very much like an evolutionary argument. Here, these structures are similar to these structures, and they point to an ancestry. In this case, a mother tongue, speaking like ancestor, a mother tongue from which they all branched out. Darwin also used this analogy in The Origin of Species. Well, having known some Hebrew, okay, I'm not an expert on Hebrew, but I know Hebrew. I know that its structure is radically different from Indo-European languages. German and Greek and English are the three that I know. Nothing like it. So in Hebrew, the verb system is structured on causation. So to give you an example, what I'm doing right now is teaching. Well, teaching, to teach, is not even a verb in Hebrew. You have the one verb, learn, and then you have cause to learn. Technically, put in a state of learning. So I lamad, I learn, and I lemaid, I cause you to learn, I teach you. There's also this causing of state, and then there's causing of action. There's nothing like that in English. Our verb structure is not based on causation. Well, I'm told that Arabic, being a Semitic language, is structured similarly. I know the vocabulary is very similar. And so here are two families, the Indo-European family of languages and the Semitic family of languages, that are structured radically different. That although I can imagine Hebrew and Arabic came from one mother tongue, and German and English came from one mother tongue, I cannot imagine how the Semitic languages and the Indo-European languages came from one grandmother tongue. It's that model that I want to apply to species. I do not believe that Darwin's straw God is the way things exist, that God looks at every little region of the world and crafted a specific species for that region, that environment. That's a straw God. That's not the God of the Bible and its history. According to the Bible, God made everything according to its kind. And then after that, it spread out, right? To multiply and fill the earth. The command was given to man, and animals did the same. They spread out. You know what happens when languages spread out. Dialects happen, and it gets harder to understand those from the previous region, and then eventually those dialects harden into languages that, though they share the same structure, now no longer enables communication. Could it be possible, whether you look at, say, the dog kind or whatever, that you started out with, maybe you have a certain proto-dog that over time speciates, there's speciation that occurs in such a way that wolves and dog and coyotes and such can develop, that though they are distinct, just like in the horse world, you know, donkey, horse are distinct, and maybe can do some crossbreeding, like with a mule or a dog-wolf, you know, kind of cross, they eventually become their own breeding populations, their own species, but the similarities in structure, the dogness, the horseness, speaks of a mother horse, as it were, a mother dog, that proto-dog that is the origin of that species. In my mind, that is entirely possible. That as the languages in Genesis began at the Tower of Babel, and God confused the tongue, and God put into the world distinct families of languages. That's the prototype that then branched out into a variety of dialects and eventually languages that didn't cross with each other. That so God put into the world certain kinds, as it says in Genesis 1, and over time, speciation occurred. Great distinction between them, so that you have different, you have African elephant, you have, you know, Asian elephant, you have woolly mammoth, mastodon, whatever it is, different elements, different continents, and yet all comes from one proto-elephant. I guess I'm open to that possibility, but I'm not open to the possibility, or at least it would take God revealing it to me, to go beyond that certain kinds start the stream and those kinds are distinct, which I think they are. And so, there you go. Some of you are wondering, that's my position. And for me, this is my faith, and I believe it to be true, and I accept the Bible at face value. And so, others have explained it differently, and I don't believe that it is necessarily a matter of being a Christian or not a Christian, but I do believe that holding the Bible or not holding the Bible is definitely a matter of being a Christian or not a Christian. And so, I hope this has been a helpful week for you, and if it has prepared the way to give Genesis a fresh hearing, it has accomplished the purpose, and for that I'm thankful. All right, have a good weekend enjoying Myers' article on the history and philosophy of the intelligent design movement.